Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. When Dr. Mark Pepler was looking for a better way to help his medical students learn about germs, he turned to hockey cards for inspiration. The result is a new product, microbe cards, and they've just hit the market. Biocontrol, Dr. Rosemary Declercq-Float at the Agriculture Canada Lethbridge Research Station, is having great success with her experiments. She's using bugs to control invasive weeds like Dalmatian toadflax and hound's tongue. And nanotechnology, Dr. Peter Gruder introduces a new program to spearhead more work in the nano field. These are the stories you'll hear on this edition of Innovation Alberta. Remember the days when you got hockey or baseball cards with your bubblegum? You collected them, traded them, and memorized all the stats about your favorite players. For Dr. Mark Pepler, that youthful passion over sports cards has paid big dividends in his adult life as a teacher and researcher. Mark is an associate professor in medical microbiology and immunology at the University of Alberta. He's taken the sports card concept and transformed it into a teaching tool for his medical students. With the help of the American Society of Microbiology, his first sets of microbe cards rolled off the press in mid-December.
These are cards that look like hockey cards, at least at the far distance. But when you get up close, you see that instead of hockey players or like baseball cards and baseball players, we've got microorganisms on them. So the main image on the front of the cards is a microorganism. There are smaller inset images that show either clinical pathology or the way the organisms grow on artificial media or maybe a histological section, that kind of thing. So a combination of both the organism, the main image, and then smaller images of those other characteristics, including sometimes diagnostic tests. Then on the other side, if you flip them over, what you see is six pieces of information that describe how the types of diseases that the organism causes, how it causes those diseases, so pathogenesis, the immunity, epidemiology, diagnosis, and control of those diseases, as well as an outline of the human body with red circles or dots on that body showing you where in the body that organism causes the disease. So that's what they look like. And then to describe to the listeners more, they're color-coded. So just by looking at the front of the card, or even the back of the card for that matter, you can tell by the color what kind of organism it is. So purple means it's a certain type of bacterium. Red means it's another type of bacterium. Yellow is virus. Green is fungus. And blue is parasite. So this is really built for the visual learner, as you can imagine. Lots of color, good imagery. There are size bars on everything, so you know exactly where you are in the measurement spectrum. And a lot of information's packed into a small little package.
What kind of diseases do these organisms cause?
Oh, they run the gamut of infectious diseases. There are 103 cards in the set, so we've got many more organisms here than you're likely to run into in your lifetime, or we hope so anyway. And we realize, too, even though this is geared for medical and nursing students primarily, that there are more organisms here than they necessarily need to know. But we're trying to cover all our bases, so to speak, carry on that sporting analogy, I guess.
Well, the thing, I wouldn't say I necessarily like this, but the thing that's really interesting about it, because you show where these organisms attack the body, the different parts, and some of them are pretty disgusting.
Well, they are. I mean, that's true. And I think we were talking amongst ourselves, too, about how different people learn information, and medical microbiologists like myself will organize these cards by the type of organism that they are. But medical students and nursing students, people in the healthcare professions, will probably organize them by the type of disease that they cause. So if you have respiratory tract pathogens, for example, doctors and nurses don't necessarily worry so much about what kind of organism it is or the type of bug that it causes. They see patients with the symptoms. So they can organize these cards by the type of disease that they cause and then know by doing that which bacteria, viruses, and fungi may cause that particular type of disease.
Why did you feel there was a need to develop this sort of teaching tool?
That's an excellent question. I think if you look in any textbook, what you tend to there are inconsistencies. And that that's not meant to be a knock against textbooks at all. There's lots of great information, but there are a couple of limitations. One is that depending on the depth you want to pursue for any particular disease or microorganism, you get an expert to write about that, and they will give you their point of view. And maybe they include a picture of the organism, maybe they don't. Maybe they show you what the disease looks like in a photograph, maybe they don't. And invariably, when they do that to save costs, it's a black and white photo. So you don't have the benefit of color, and you don't necessarily get a consistent presentation of all the same aspects of the disease process or what that organism is about, like you do in this format in the trading cards.
Why did you settle on this idea as opposed to something else? How did you get the idea, and how did you grow the idea in order to get to the point where you've got a product now that's out there in the marketplace?
Well, I guess that stems from my passion in my youth of collecting baseball cards and seeing the inherent value of them, because you get those beautiful color pictures of the players and their logos and all that stuff on the front. But on the back, in the original cards anyway, you get the entire career of that player. All the stats of how many at-bats, how many walks, hits, put-outs, all that kind of thing. And that's really a lot of information in a small space. And I was always impressed by that, even when I was young. When my sons started collecting hockey cards about 14 years ago, it came back to me. And at that point, I was teaching medical microbiology. And I thought, well, I wonder, you know, could we put these two ideas together? So I really had the idea about 14 years ago, but it was when I started teaching nursing students, it really came to me that this is the time to try this, because as it turned out, they found it of real benefit to them.
What kind of testing did you go through to find out what would be a good format, what was working and what wasn't?
That started out not as a card format, but just as the idea of consolidating the same information for each microorganism. So basically what's on the back of the card, and then something similar to what I might have had on the front of the card. And I asked the nursing students, they were divided into tutorial groups of 10 or 12 students. And I assigned each tutorial group five organisms to give me an image and these six pieces of information, which I said I would collate and then send back to the class so everybody would have a copy of all the organisms. And my colleague Bob Rennie and I had selected 30 to 40 organisms that we thought were the most important ones for them to know, which was the basis for which ones would they look up. So they did that, and I cheated. I mean, I didn't send back what they had actually done. For more consistency, I had created my own files so that the wording would be similar and that kind of thing. And then at that point, I just took common images from textbooks just to try out the idea. And, of course, that was only photocopied, so it was black and white, and the images didn't come out very well. And it was an inferior product. But even then, they found them really quite helpful. So that gave me tremendous encouragement. And I built a prototype in full color with the help of my graphic artist, John Dreger, who was working at the Academic Technologies for Learning production studio when it existed over in education. And we started this partnership, built the test cards, if you will. I pitched it first to my colleagues who were teaching med micro and nursing, and they really liked it. And that's all I needed. And I just needed a sponsor after that, if you will. And to be faithful to the card format, we went to with the help of Bernadette Oreski at the Research Services Office, we went to Topps, the major card manufacturer in the United States, and they said, well, great idea, but we don't do educational cards. We just do entertainment and sports. So good luck. So faced with that, what do we do now? And we went to the American Society for Microbiology, and Jeff Holtmeyer, who's an adventurous editor, I must say, liked the idea and gave us support and said, yeah. So we signed the contract in June of 2000, and it took us from then to actually get all the images together. And although we had quite a set of images that my friend Mark Joffe had collected from our colleagues around Edmonton, various infectious disease people had their own personal slides that contribute a lot of the clinical images that you see here. And the rest, I guess you could say, is history.
what's next. It doesn't end here, I'm sure.
Well, we do have in the works a subsequent set of cards, which we're going to call antimicrobe cards. So those would include all the antimicrobials, what we would call antibiotics. But beyond the antibacterial drugs, which we're familiar with, newer antiviral drugs, antifungals, antiparasitic drugs as well. So that is another bugaboo for medical and nursing students, because there are lots of antimicrobials that they need to know for therapeutic purposes to treat these microbes. So that's why antimicrobe cards. And on those, it'll be the chemical structure of the antibiotic. And then on the back, lots of pertinent information about therapeutic levels, levels of toxicity, what the mechanisms of action are, that kind of thing.
Where do people get a hold of these?
Through the American Society for Microbiology Press, or ASM Press. There's a website, www.asmpress.org/. And you can acquire the cards there. Alternatively, here in Alberta, the University of Alberta Bookstore is carrying them. So you can get it through them, either through the website or stop by.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Mark Pepler, an associate professor of microbiology and immunology in the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry at the University of Alberta. Dandelions are just one of the many non-native plants that invaded North America when Europeans began settling the New World. Two invasive species that are really causing problems for ranchers on the prairies are Dalmatian toadflax, a type of snapdragon, and another called hound's tongue. These can poison cattle and horses, and the burrs get caught on their hides. Dr. Rosemary de Klerk-Float is an entomologist at the Agriculture Canada Research Station in Lethbridge. Her research focuses on how to use biological controls rather than chemical pesticides.
I guess economically, they're taking over these grasslands and displacing forages that are valued by a ranching community. And so they cost the ranchers and lost grazing land. Some of them are poisonous. Hound's tongue is highly poisonous. They just displace all these native plants that are also valued by society these days. So it's more than just helping out the farmers and ranchers that we're also helping the general public.
So it's not something that you would go out and spray some pesticide on. You're looking at using natural forms to control them.
Oh, definitely. And that's the whole intent of this, is to reduce pesticide use. Feel that that these pesticides or herbicides are probably doing a lot of damage to the environment and to non-target plants as well. But in many of these situations where we're applying biocontrol, there are no alternatives. It'd be just too costly to apply the chemicals needed to control. Like, we're talking about hundreds and thousands of hectares of land that are invaded by weeds like knapweed. And, you know, that it's amazing. It's amazing. Like, these plants are literally taking over. So there's no way that the ranchers can recover the cost of these herbicides, so they don't spray anything. But they definitely don't want them there either.
So what are you using then?
Well, I'll just give an example. We're, like for hound's tongue, we're using insects that originated in the place where the weed came from. And we're using these little root weevils that are working quite well. They were tested over a period of 9 years. We tested them on other plant species to ascertain that they preferred feeding on hound's tongue. And then we petitioned the Canadian government. And also, there's also a committee in the United States that reviews the petitions, and they determined it was safe to release in Canada. So we made the first releases in 1997, and the insect has done quite well.
So what results are you getting with these guys?
Well, we did some experiments. Now, this little insect was wonderful because we were able to mass produce it in the laboratory. So we were able to do some experiments looking at the optimum number to release in a patch of hound's tongue to guarantee establishment and impact. And the experiment turned out so well. Like, it's rare that that the insects do this well. But we were able to get complete patch level control within 2 years at rates of 300, 400 insects. So it's very unusual to get an insect working that quickly.
And there's no chance that these will become a pest in themselves?
Well, that's why we do this testing, as I mentioned. And like I said, 9 years of testing, it took a lot of effort to get the native plant species to test, because there's used to be that the concern was mostly with horticultural or economic plant species to make sure the insect wouldn't feed on them. But more and more, we've been testing native plants as well.
What other projects are you working on?
Well, working also on Dalmatian Toadflax, as I mentioned. And this plant is also highly invasive, especially in the southern interior of British Columbia, and also the foothills and southern Alberta. So, yeah, we've been involved with that project much longer than the Hound's Tongue project, and we've had a number of insects released. But a stem, little weevil that burrows in the stems, is doing quite well.
Where would you have to bring those over from?
Well, there were collections made in the Rhine Valley of Germany, and I believe there's also a population that we tested from Hungary. Just getting back to the testing, it's amazing how much effort goes into doing these tests. But we actually will test individual populations. We don't trust that anything just from the same species will have the same host range, and we never choose something that based on the literature that has a broad host range. We purposely pick insects that are very specific on the targeted weed.
You wouldn't want to have to be importing these all the time. Do you have a program in place where you can actually grow your own?
That's a good question. The problem is in implementing biocontrol or encouraging people to implement it is the availability of the insects. And with the Hound's Tongue project particularly, it's been so successful that the demand has been much higher than the supply of insects. And so I've actually had the ranching community approached me, a number of stockmen's associations in BC that are really anxious to get these insects, especially when they saw how well they were doing in this one experiment. And so they said, well, you know, we would like to invest in a project that would allow you to mass rear these insects or for us to mass rear them and provide them to the general ranching community in BC. And so originally they had in mind mass production in a laboratory setting, and even though we can do that and we've been very successful at it, it takes specialized facilities that are very costly to operate, and also it takes high paid expertise. So I pitched something very novel at them, and I suggested that we mass produce them in a farm setting. That means we're learning how to row crop our weed, and we're going to sow our insects into this crop and then harvest the insects after they've developed for a couple of years.
So you've almost turned this weed into a cash crop.
Well, yeah, maybe. And, you know, the amazing thing is that the ranchers are still pretty excited about it. Like, we've had ranchers donating their time and going out and collecting the weed seed so that I would have enough to sow for these experiments. And they've been providing funding and even offering up land to try this out on. It's a novel way of looking at things. And, I mean, of course, we've been very careful. Like, we will be careful not to let this plant go to seed and become a further problem. But I do believe it's a good method, especially for this insect. And it's something that people don't think about. They think, well, you know, this insect has lots of food to feed on out there. But if you grow healthier and bigger plants in a crop setting, you can probably get, orders of magnitude more insects produced that might be even healthier if you fertilize your weed or whatever. You might get healthier and bigger insects that can establish better and work better for the ranchers.
What do these little bugs actually do in order to cut down on the weeds?
Well, they're very effective in the respect that they feed on the roots in the early developmental stages or in the larval stages. And I think it's a combination of things. Like, nothing ever works alone. And from our experiments, we know that we were running this experiment at the same time we were getting a drought as well. So, I mean, it's a little too early to tell, but I think if you're looking at mechanisms, like the larvae are probably having a major impact on the uptake of water by these plants. So in a drought year, that's probably a double whammy on the plants. The experiment was controlled, so we know that the insects definitely were having a role in killing off these plants because our control plots had plants yet on them.
What's next for you?
Oh, well, we really want to get this project up and running. We've already seeded our first crop of hound's tongue. Actually, we're in the process of doing that now, and we've got some land that has been provided by some ranchers and farmers in southern BC. So actually, they're going out next week to finish seeding, and we also have the experiments running here at Lethbridge. So we're hoping, and we're mass-producing the first seed insects in the lab this winter. So we're going to be releasing them next spring. And so far, everything's really worked quite well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Rosemarie Declercq-Float. She's an entomologist and biocontrol expert at the Agriculture Canada Research Station in Lethbridge. At a recent workshop in Edmonton sponsored by the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Dr. Peter Gruder introduced a new funding program from NSERC, the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada. It's called the Nano Innovation Platform, or Nano-IP for short. Peter Gruder is an associate professor in physics at McGill University.
It's a realization of NSERC's that nano is interdisciplinary, that Canada doesn't really have a strategy what we should be doing in nano, and that one needs to develop the strategy and that we need to be able to fund the interdisciplinary nano things. The other part is that the community is telling NSERC that we need more money for nano, and so we need to be a little more specific if we go to the government and ask for more money. What is it exactly for, and what are we going to do with it? That's part of the role of this nano-IP platform.
What types of things will you be funding? Because one of the things that you've mentioned today is that you're looking for high-risk projects. What's that mean?
High-risk project. Right now, the nano-IP has $1 million per year for 5 years. And that's a lot of money on one side. On the other hand, it's not a lot of money. So we've decided with an advisory committee that we're going to put a substantial amount of this money, $600,000, $700,000, into 6-7 high-risk, high-payoff projects. High-risk means that it should be far out, so not just incremental changes. And, you know, I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing, and I just need a little bit more money, but really something with a vision. I'm going to essentially use this as a probe to see what hot things are brewing in the various labs across the country to essentially be able to find some of the cutting-edge science within Canada with this program. So that's one aspect of it. It's also that NSERC and every funding agency tends to be fairly conservative in what things it funds, and some of the nano things are outlandish. Some of them are science fiction. Other things are just, you know, outside of the norm that can be evaluated that they're actually reasonable and scientifically correct and all those things. And then we will, based on excellence of the project, we will fund these. Another fraction of the money will be used to try and stimulate and help grow local communities of nano researchers. So in Quebec, we have funding from the provincial government at the tune of $10 million for 2 years for nanoscience. And one of the things that that Nano Quebec does is it organizes yearly workshops, one-day workshops, where essentially everybody that thinks they're doing nano research puts up a poster. And so what that leads to is very interdisciplinary community of people, essentially students that are going to be the next generation that are going to work in the small companies, bigger companies, you know, making nano into our everyday lives. But they need to know what is going on in the local area, because that's your pool of people that you're going to pull from if you start a company, for example. And we would like to stimulate that. It's happening here in Edmonton thanks to NUNT, but it should be done all over the country in the various centres. And so local being defined within 2 hours' drive. So that people really said that the cost issue is not big. So essentially, we will subsidize. We'll pay for the venue and poster boards and lunch and those kind of things. But people do not have to fly in or come with a hotel. Small companies, they don't have the time to go to a workshop and spend day flying in, half a day there, day flying out again. Whereas, and they're rooted in the local community. That's where you're going to have the biggest impact. So we want to do this across the country, essentially. So that's the second major aspect where we're going to be spending money. And then the other parts of it is essentially with NINT and other stakeholders, CIHR in particular, so the Canadian Institute of Health Research, to develop a strategy of what should we be focusing on in Canada.
If you're looking at this idea of strategy and focus, how does that fit with what the National Institute for Nanotechnology is all about? Are you working together or in competition?
No, we're working closely together. I mean, Dan and I know each other pretty well, and essentially the last few weeks I found out much more about what NINT is, where they're trying to head to, you know, their internal discussions or so. I think we should not be competing within Canada. Our competition is south of the border and across the oceans. And we will work strongly towards that goal, essentially, to create a com. NINT is is an important part of the stakeholder of all the players in nano in Canada. It's very good, I think, that it was established, but it's only a starting point. And together with NINT and the other stakeholders, I think we will be able to get something reasonable done in Canada in this field.
How do you raise the profile of Canada's role in nanotechnology around the world?
That's one small step are these projects, because they're going to be internationally peer-reviewed by big leaders around the world. So they will actually notice that there's some interesting stuff going on in Canada too. I think NINT helped a lot in that respect. The other aspect is that if $1 million or $100 million Canadian dollars are spent on research in Canada, so that's not only true for nano, it's true generally for research, and you spend $100 million in the US, even if it's U.S. dollars versus Canadian dollars, our Canadian dollars will go much further, because the cost of doing research or funding research here are substantially lower. To give you two examples, if you get a grant in the U.S. from the NSF, from the National Science Foundation, there is typically between 40 and 60% overhead involved, which your university takes. So out of my 100,000 U.S. or million U.S. dollars, I've only got maybe $400,000 left. Then there's things like summer salaries, the fact that tuition fees are substantially higher, and I'll have to pay for that. So a typical U.S. grad student will cost me somewhere between $40,000 to $60,000 U.S. dollars, whereas a grad student, so I need that size grant, whereas a grad student here, at least in physics and McGill, costs my grant $15,000 Canadian. So the fact I already have a factor of four less dollars Canadian versus U.S. dollars that I need to get the same effect, one grad student. And that needs to be trumpeted out to the world, that essentially the cost of doing research and development here in Canada, although we have a high tax rate, et cetera, is possibly cheaper than many other places in the world. And so if we spend just $100 million, we might actually get the same amount of bang for the buck, like $500 million US.
For people who are interested, how do they find out more or get in touch with you?
Right now, since our website is only going to go online in a couple of weeks or so. So right now, probably the easiest via email, which is Grutter, G-R-U-T-T-E-R, @physics.mcgill.ca.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Dr. Peter Grutter, an associate professor in physics at McGill University in Montreal. And he's involved with the NSERC Nano Innovation Platform program. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website. The web address is innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to the weekly Innovation Alberta Online newsletter. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, and welcome aboard to our newest sponsor, the Capital Region Innovation Centre. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.